Docket is Munoz versus Meisner. And again, I want to advise counsel, Justice Hobbs was not able to be with us this afternoon, but he intends to he does intend to participate in the decision of this case. So we're ready to hear from the petitioner.
May it please the court, my name is Jonathan Willett, and I'm here for the petitioners, Mr. and Mrs. Munoz. Obviously, the issue before the court is the trial procedure when the trial court determines that a denial of a request for attorney's fees is warranted. The plaintiff's position here is that the procedure for a denial of attorney's fees is clearly stated by legislative direction under CRS 1317-102-4. There, essentially, the court has to engage in a preliminary inquiry that the basis of the inquiry is whether a claim or defense lacks substantial justification, was interposed for purposes of delay or harassment, needlessly expanded the litigation, and essentially it also says there that lacking substantial justification also means that the claim is substantially frivolous, substantially groundless, substantially vexatious. It's the petitioner's position that the next statute, CRS 1317-103, controls the trial court's findings upon the grant of attorney's fees, that these two statutes are clear, that they're separate, that the court must first engage in the inquiry presented by the former statute, subsection 102, and then if it decides a grant of attorney's fees is warranted, it must then proceed to 103. The purpose of findings, as the court is well aware, is to facilitate appellate review. The purpose of attorney's fees is to deter bad faith or egregious conduct on the part of the offending party. Once a decision is made by a trial court that attorney's fees are not warranted, that should end the inquiry. And if the court determines that attorney's fees are warranted, it would go on to subsection 103. There is no ambiguity in these statutes. And why we say that is because the first section, subsection 102, subsection 4, says the court shall assess attorney's fees if, then it goes on to say the standards. That is clear. The operative phase there is the court shall assess attorney's fees if. And the operative phase in subsection 103, subsection 1 states, when granting an award of attorney's fees. So essentially, we believe the statutes are clear that the legislature clearly determined that the first step is under 102. And then the second step, should the court decide that some claim is substantially frivolous, then 103 lays out the procedure once that is done. The respondents argue in this case that the findings that the court made on summary judgment here essentially equate to a claim of substantial justification, of lack of substantial justification. And we would observe this court's holding in Torres versus Portillo, 638 P. 2nd 274, that when someone loses a claim, that's not the equivalent that the claim lacks substantial justification. And why that is because the standards the court apply, for instance, in this case, when the court was faced with a question of summary judgment, whether there's no dispute as to a material fact in the case, is a much different inquiry than the inquiry whether the claims lacked substantial justification. Because of that, it is not right to conclude that the loss of an issue on summary judgment is the same thing as saying the claims were frivolous. The standards are different. Now, the court made findings in this case, and this wasn't a case like the case that the Court of Appeals relied upon in making its ruling, which is the Stearns case, where the court just said the request for attorney's fees is denied. This is not a case like that. This is a case where the court engaged in a thoughtful hearing that lasted an entire day, at which time that was just set on the inquiry about attorney's fees, where a lot of evidence was presented, a lot of arguments were made. Then the court asked for briefs on the issue, and we briefed the issue, both sides did, and the respondents here were even afforded the opportunity for a reply brief. And then the court, in its order denying the request for attorney's fees, went through the history of the case, the history of the case law, went through the facts, and essentially it observed this was a super hostile case, that it was a complex case, that there were allegations of fictitious deeds being involved, that the plaintiffs did present their claims in good faith. And I think part of what the court has to acknowledge or maybe consider in the background here is that we're dealing with a situation that involves an attorney who took over the case from the attorney who actually filed the claims, and then that second attorney, for one reason or another, decided to withdraw. A week before trial, 2 weeks before trial, he files this motion to withdraw. Then at the withdrawal hearing, he essentially makes comments which appear to include client-attorney confidential communications, damning his own clients, and then he does the same thing again at the hearing. So, just intuitively, this suggests that perhaps an assessment of attorney's fees against the clients who have a limited grasp of English and legal principles is also unwarranted, because there was at least an ostensible claim that the attorney's conduct in failing to understand his own case was what produced the loss of certain issues on summary judgment. And there is a case in here, Anderson Boneless Beef, which is cited in petitioner's brief, that says it's generally inappropriate to assess attorney's fees if it appears to be the attorney's fault. And we would note that there wasn't a request for attorney's fees against the attorney himself, but rather that was to be assessed against the plaintiffs in the underlying quiet title action.
Mr. Millett?
Yes, sir.
So what do you do with Rule 121?
121, that's a fine question, Your Honor. And essentially what 121 says is that the court must make findings. That's what it says. And to us, that means findings sufficient for appellate review. And it doesn't say specifically, as the Court of Appeals held, that when you deny attorney's fees, you must make findings on each claim or defense. 121 just says findings.
I was looking for it. I don't have it in front of me, but sure, I thought it said findings of fact. Is that?
Yeah. And I think that's valid too, findings of fact. And that's what the court did in this case.
How do we integrate that into your argument?
The way I think that would be integratable is by saying that here in this case, the judge obviously engaged in a thoughtful analysis of the defendant's request for attorney's fees and made findings of fact sufficient for appellate review. It appears that the
case... Just not on each claim?
Just not on each individual claim, as is required by subsection 103 only. Subsection 102.4 doesn't say that. And subsection 103 only says, upon the grant of attorney's fees, you've got to make claims on each thing, on each request. And that makes sense, Your Honor, because essentially, if the court is going to engage in the extreme sanction of awarding attorney's fees for the defense of each claim, then it's appropriate for the offending party on appeal to be able to have something to address in appealing that issue, those issues. So, and one other thing I just observed for the court's benefit is that nowhere in the pleadings in the court below did respondents raise this specific findings request or claim under 1317.103. It wasn't even addressed there. It's almost like it was later on developed as a possible way for the appeal to go forward.
How was it raised in the appeal?
It was raised in the Court of Appeals.
Okay.
And that was the basis of their ruling. And they cited this Stearns case that I previously alluded to, where the court essentially engaged in a one-liner and said, request for attorney's fees denied. Here we've got a full written order with factual findings, legal findings, well-reasoned conclusions by a fine judge, Judge Moss, a fair and gentlemanly man. And so we suggest that the trial court was correct there. In summary, and I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal, the statutes aren't ambiguous. Rule 103 subsection 103, 1317.103, didn't come into play because the first inquiry was answered negatively. The award of attorney's fees is not appropriate here. So we would ask that the court reverse the Court of Appeals, essentially affirming the judgment of the trial court. And thank you.
May it please the court and counsel. My name is Jennifer Lynn Peters, and I am here today on behalf of the respondents, the defendants in the case below, Linda Meisner and her son, Devin Meisner. I think I need to start initially by pointing out that Mr. Willett and I have a fundamental difference of whether or not the trial court made factual findings pertaining to the motion for fees. I submit he did not. There is not a single factual finding in the trial court's written order about the motion for attorney's fees that details what evidence he thought the plaintiffs tried to submit in good faith that supported their claims. On the contrary, what the trial court did was go through an analysis of, here's what the legal standards are for finding a claim frivolous or groundless. Here's my summary of the totality of the case, and that it was a wild made-for-TV factual scenario. And I find, despite the fact of what I ruled on summary judgment, the claims were not frivolous and groundless. While he used more words than the trial court did in Stearns, what the trial court did here is the same. He said, the claims are not frivolous and groundless, and I deny the motion for fees without any supporting factual findings.
But he found, did he not, that the plaintiffs had prevailed on part of the case?
He did find the plaintiffs had prevailed on the quiet title piece of the case, which was not a claim on which the defendants were seeking attorney's fees. The facts of this case are a little important here because the case essentially took two turns. The first case involved a quiet title claim to a 700-square-foot triangular piece of property in Milliken, Colorado, of which the parties were fighting over. While the ruling on that piece was on appeal in the Court of Appeals, the Munozes added four tort claims against the Meisners for which they sought $250,000 in damages. And those are the claims that were tried then after the quiet title piece was affirmed and which went forward for the next 3 years and are which the motion for fees was addressed to. And those are actually the claims in that piece of the case that we're here for today because there was never any factual support and in some cases, not even legal support for those claims, especially as they pertain to Linda Meisner.
So before you go on, is the trial judge just wrong then when he says that the plaintiffs prevailed on some of the claims, or is he just mixing the two cases together? What's going
It's
on?
One case, but they essentially feel like two because they took so long. They were bifurcated for purposes of trial, and he's absolutely right. The Munoz has prevailed on the one claim, the quiet title action. They lost on the four tort claims. And the reason the Court of Appeals opinion in this case correctly found that the trial court abused its discretion in not looking at our request for fees on a claim-by-claim basis is because it's not the quiet title piece that we take issue with. It's the unsupported tort claims that never had a basis in fact or in law that dragged this case beyond another 3 years.
So, and you, excuse me, but you were just claiming attorney's fees for that portion of the case?
That's correct.
Of the case?
Okay. That's correct. We were only seeking fees as it pertained to the tort case, which were easily identifiable because they essentially took the appearance of two separate cases in the same case. What's important here, and I think this case illustrates, is that the court essentially has before it, I think, two issues. I realize it was framed as one. There's a disagreement among opinions issued by the Court of Appeals, the Stearns opinion, which makes it clear the court must make factual findings to support its grant or denial of a motion for fees under the frivolous and groundless statute. And I think Stearns also makes, and the Court of Appeals in this case extended that to, the court should also consider the factors under 1317.103 when making those findings. I think the court here needs to take this opportunity to resolve first and foremost, when a court denies a motion for fees, does it have to make specific factual findings? Because there seems to be some disagreement in the Court of Appeals opinions about that. The second inquiry is, if when they're making that determination, do they also look at the factors under 1317.103? It's our position that the court should look at those factors. And while I recognize the front half of that 1317.103 statute says, when granting, the court must make specific findings and take into account these factors, that section also says, when determining whether to award attorney's fees, when you harmonize that piece of the statute with the requirements in Rule 121, Section 122, that in resolving a motion for fees, the court makes specific factual findings, it may, and the legislative intent in 1317.101 that the statutes be construed liberally to defray and try to discourage this type of frivolous litigation, this type of adding a claim to maybe what started out as a legitimate case and then became not legitimate because of these added claims. Harmonizing all of that together requires that not only does the court have to make findings, even if they say denied, that those findings should also include some sort of reference to the factors in 1317.103. This case in particular, I think, illustrates why that's necessary. 1317.102, subsections 2 and 4, make it mandatory that the trial court award fees if it finds claims lack substantial justification. Setting aside whether claims were brought in good faith or not, setting aside all the other requirements in that set or the other possibilities, if the court finds that it lacks substantial justification, meaning it was frivolous or groundless, 1317.102, 2 and 4 make it mandatory. If you look only at the slander of title claim brought in this case, there was never any legal or factual basis, which is the definition of a frivolous and groundless claim. There was never a legal or factual basis for that claim.
That may be true, but that's found otherwise.
Correct. But he made no specific findings of fact as to why that was his finding. And the point I'm trying to make with that illustration is, if the trial court doesn't have to do it claim by claim when he's presented with the type of argument we gave him, that a portion of a civil action was frivolous and groundless, and he doesn't give the appellate court specific findings for why he decided claims had merit or weren't frivolous and groundless, the appellate courts have no way to review those determinations. And so a denial of a request for fees, as in this case, becomes unreviewable, and the statute loses its teeth. If a trial court can just say, your motion for fees is denied with no further findings, no consideration, if the trial courts don't have to go through a claim-by-claim analysis when someone says these particular parts of this case lack substantial justification, then the denials are never appealed. And if the trial, and then that statute, as it was not followed in this case, is never subject to reversal.
Counsel, doesn't the judge incorporate, not so much in his motion denying fees, but on page 3 of 4 on in that motion, his earlier findings in his order, he's calling his order granting in part and denying in part defendant's motions for summary judgment.
He does.
He says he reviewed those motions and he looked at those for purposes of determining whether there was a violation and there wasn't. So if we go back to those motions, which and so he's just basically not repeating himself, then we get the facts that would allow us to be able to have an adequate appellate review, don't we?
Potentially, but that also illustrates my problem, especially on the slander of title. In his order on the summary judgment motions, the trial court judge here specifically said no evidence was presented in support of the slander of title claim. None. And then yet, in his order on fees, he concludes that that claim was not frivolous or groundless. But if there was no evidence to support it, it's by definition groundless, making the award of attorney's fees mandatory. It's that contradiction between his order on fees and what he said on summary judgment that makes it difficult in this case and illustrates why specific findings in the order on the motion for fees were required in this case. And all we're asking this court to do, in addition to clearing up whether the trial courts must make findings of fact when denying a motion as well as granting it, is to affirm the Court of Appeals opinion here, which sends this case back to the trial court to specifically say what facts, what evidence was it he was relying on in determining.
Counsel, it seems to me that the argument that findings are lacking and the consequence of that is that it's not reviewable rather suggests that there are disputed facts about which a finding would be necessary because the appellate court can't decide that itself and the record which would include, as Justice Rice has indicated, the previous orders are not sufficient for the appellate court to make that determination. Can you give me some specifics or example of what facts are at issue, what the trial court did not resolve that it should have in order to allow this to be reviewable?
That's a very good question. I think in this case, the trial court at the hearing and in the motion on the fees was presented with analysis of 4 tort claims in which we contended that there was no facts to support it, and on the very few claims that they were arguing there was a slander of title because there was this alleged fictitious deed, that wasn't enough as a legal basis to render that claim valid, that the putting up of a security camera was not in and of itself support of this of their claim for outrageous conduct, that there were, and I think, let me backtrack, the motion for summary judgment, the only evidence that the court was looking at to dispute what we had raised was an affidavit of Virginia Munoz. She's the only witness who testified on behalf of the Munozes at trial. So to the extent there were something in her testimony that he found compelling or that he relied, the trial court relied on in the hearing when he heard her testify directly, there were no findings about what those were to tell us how they overcame those hurdles about the legal requirements and the factual requirements.
I understand that the factual findings may assist the review, but why can't an appellate court look at that and decide whether there was any evidence at all in support of the claim?
I think a court can. I think the appellate courts can in a situation where there's a fully developed factual record and where the trial court makes it clear what his reasons were for the denial of the motion for fees.
And is that lacking here? And if so, in what respect?
In this particular case, I think what's lacking is the trial court's, whether or not the trial court applied the right standards, I guess, is what I think is lacking in terms of.
Well, now you seem to be shifting from factual findings, and we're now talking about whether the trial court's reasoning is adequate for appellate review?
Correct. And let me explain. I think, in our opinion, it's our position that the record here clearly shows there was never any support for these outrageous conduct, trespass, or particularly slander of title claims, and that the trial court was required to award fees, and I think the Court of Appeals could have said, there's no support in this record, he abused his discretion, and we're going back. So I'm having difficulty telling you what specific fact is missing because, in my opinion, there aren't any facts to draw from in the first place. But I think what's lacking in the trial court's order here that led the Court of Appeals to say, go back and give us more, is the fact that the trial court sort of did a totality of the circumstances look, like you do when you're trying to determine who gets costs under Rule 54D, and not a claim by claim is part of this civil action, as the statutes say in 1317.102 or 103, lacking a substantial justification.
But I think the opinion's pretty, the trial court opinion seems pretty clear that the trial judge finds that each party prevailed on some of the claims and that they're both prevailing parties for parts of the case.
Correct, but that has no bearing on whether or not a claim lacks substantial justification under 1317.102.
Well, I understand that, but why, I don't understand why the Court of Appeals couldn't review that, why there had to be a remand.
Putting myself in the shoes of the Court of Appeals, what I suspect is they were struggling with, with why the trial court, despite there being a lack of evidence and despite it finding there was no evidence presented in support of the majority of these tort claims on summary judgment, contradicted itself in its order on fees. And I suspect the Court of Appeals here, one, wanted to address this dispute or contradiction between their own opinions about what findings and what factors should be considered, and two, give the trial court an opportunity to correct his own order and clear up that contradiction himself. As I've said, I struggle with that question because I think the Court of Appeals could have, in this case, said, based on the record before us, there's no evidence to support the conclusions of law made by the trial court in this case. I still agree with the Court of Appeals that there is no factual findings in that order on attorney's fees that supports that conclusion of law, that these claims here were not frivolous and groundless.
I think what I'm hearing you say, and you can correct me, please, if I get it wrong, I think you're saying that this case really was quite divisible and was divided in along the bifurcated lines, and therefore it should be, when it comes down to the request for attorney's fees, should have been considered on that basis as well, even though the plaintiff appealed on the quiet title, that you were entitled to have the judge look solely at the other claims.
Correct, and I
because
think
because they were so separate.
Yes, and I actually think the statute allows and requires for that. In 1317.102 and in 103, it talks about if the court finds, if I may finish my thought.
Oh, go ahead.
If the court finds that a civil action or any part thereof is used throughout that frivolous and groundless statutes, it's that or any part thereof that was meant, I believe, to allow the trial courts to look at individual claims as opposed to an entire case as a whole. And I think the error here is that the trial court just lumped it all together and didn't bother to look, as we had asked him to, at each individual claim. Because in this case, there was no support for those tort claims whatsoever, and yet the Meisners have had to defend those for years. So we would ask you to affirm the Court of Appeals and reverse the denial of our request for fees.
Rebuttal?
Thank you.
I take issue with my colleague here that in the hearing of August 8th, they asked for individual determination of each claim under 1317.103. I also would point out for the court's benefit that the tort claims here in large part were dismissed for failure to prosecute after the attorney was permitted to withdraw and the plaintiffs asked for a continuance to prepare a trial. Then the court said, well, I'm dismissing this for failure to prosecute. So, again, we have a different basis. And then I would note, Your Honors, that there was a lot of evidence produced at the hearing showing that the claims were not frivolously presented. And most notably, the outrageous conduct claim was based upon one of the defendants having been the mayor of this town, using the town's resources to dump dirt on the plaintiff's property, to have them prosecuted for trespass, and as the court originally found, which was affirmed by the Court of Appeals in an 03 CA case that the mayor had falsely altered deeds in public records. So there was a lot of evidence there presented, and somehow this attorney who withdrew didn't make that connection in his response to the motion for summary judgment. And then also it's important to note that the defendants didn't really bear their burden of proof. Their evidence on each individual claim was presented by the partner of the firm, Fred Otis, who at pages 101 to 104 of the August 8th transcript could not discern between different claims. He had to talk about this case as a whole. He couldn't even discern between the case that was filed with the defendants as plaintiffs and this case. He couldn't disseminate and discern between different parts of those cases. So there really wasn't a good presentation of evidence on each claim by the defendants themselves. With regarding the Court of Appeals holding, I think really the only disagreement that the Court of Appeals had was with all of its prior cases. Essentially, it cited this E-470 case versus Jagow. It cited this Webster versus Boone case, and it acknowledged that there we haven't previously required findings on a denial of attorney's fees. But somehow they got to that point in this case without overruling those cases. Lastly, I would observe that what the respondents asked the court to do is, I think, physically unworkable. Because if you've got this extended, protracted litigation where parties are making hundreds and hundreds of claims and a denial of attorney's fees would be made, then it requires trial courts to make individual findings on these complaints that have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of claims. Well, I don't know about hundreds, but anyway, thank you for your time. Have a good day.
I want to thank counsel for your arguments. The case will stand.